Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Consecration, which sucks.
It began promisingly and then became one of the most horrible movies we've covered, at least in, I don't know, recent weeks.
You always start out with that conclusion, and then you're like, well, wait, we've watched some real crap. I don't know.
Yeah, I always wind up attaching such a wimpy qualifier to it because we're always neck deep in dreck. It's done in by just ludicrous screenwriting. Just terrible, terrible. Wouldn't pass muster as like a campfire horror story. I'm talking about chronically putting the cart before the horse, something that we're always doing or accusing ourselves of doing on the podcast. I think I just said a doing. Did I just say? I must be still infested by the spirit of Russell Crowe. Just got a little bit of a...
a doing. Yeah. The Pope.
Just twists deployed in a really idiotic, illogical manner. Fever dream. Though the whole back half of it is just a fucking fever dream.
Well, the screenwriting choices are probably the biggest problem, but the direction is also kind of a train wreck, particularly near the end. It's just all around a mess.
Have you seen anything else by Christopher Smith, your namesake?
Right. No, I have not. Not to my knowledge.
As fate would have it, just in recent months, in 2023... I've seen Triangle, which I didn't like at all, and Creep, not to be confused with the one with Mark Duplass. It's the one set on the London Underground, and that one was okay. He's got a couple other movies that are supposed to be pretty good. He's got an okay-ish reputation overall. This movie started out as, I would say, better than okay-ish, albeit not great, but promising, like I said, and then just took a terrible, terrible nosedive. Like there's a scene in this movie where a series of nuns leap to their deaths like lemmings. And that's sort of what watching the movie is like. You're at a distance just watching this swan dive into oblivion that you're helpless to stop.
Yeah. So I had thought, and I believe I characterized it as such in last episode's outro, but I had thought this was an exorcism movie because, you know, it's a churchy horror movie, so I think I can be forgiven that assumption, particularly when we try not to prejudice ourselves or spoil things by reading too much ahead of time. As it turns out, there's no exorcisms or really possession involved, at least I don't think so, and this is coming from someone who, again, just watched the film. I ought to be able to know, but it's kind of a mess. The basic pitch for this movie is that Jenna Malone plays a woman, an English woman, which I also didn't know going in. She is very not English, sort of the reverse of the more typical popular trend of having every English actor or actress hold their nose closed and affect an American accent.
Yeah.
I've been making fun of Benedict Cumberbatch saying the word chakras in Doctor Strange for the last 6.5 years, and will probably continue to do so for the next 6.5. But Jenna Malone, American actress, this time playing an English woman, and her brother, estranged brother, who was a priest, has died under mysterious circumstances near a convent in Scotland. And she sort of goes up there to look into things. There's both more to it and, in a weird way, a lot less to it.
Yeah. But it's maybe the most short on intrigue of any mystery movie I can remember seeing. There's not much in the way of red herrings or blind alleys or suspicious supporting players. You know, I mean, there's the nuns in the convent who are just kind of uniformly sinister.
Yeah,
and
pretty
none
much
of them makes much of an impression other than, I guess, the Mother Superior, because she has seniority. And then you have Danny Houston as well, being his usual menacing self. So, right. Without further ado, we open with, you just said it, it's Jenna, right? Not Gina?
Jenna, yes.
Jenna. It opens with Jenna Malone, and she's narrating to us. When I was a kid, my brother thought that I had a guardian angel, but I never believed in it. So right away we think, correctly, sort of. Oh, so she's the skeptic, her brother was the believer. This sets up the usual dichotomy that you get in movies like this. And Jenna Malone is going to have to find her faith in order to beat this movie's would-be Pazuzu, whoever it turns out to be. And then a nun with a gun walks up to Jenna Malone, sporting like a dirty, hairy glare, and trains the gun on her. This is an in medias res opening. Pretty goofy, but I was sort of tickled by it. We cut back a ways, and we get a little bit of Jenna Malone's kind of humdrum life. She has one scene with a friend of hers, who, and there's some gentle ribbing. He accuses her of being a hermit. I was only half paying attention to all of this. I was running late to start. I knew we had to record, so I was faffing about while the movie was playing, and then I settled in and actually tried to do my due diligence. But all of this is to say, I mistook this character for the brother who dies for like longer than I care to admit. And I thought that was rather deft, because he's introduced to us in the opening scene, and it's not, there's no like heavy-handed, you know, this is my last day on the force kind of thing where you think, oh, that character's a goner.
Two days to retirement.
Exactly. I think it was on The Simpsons, one of the McBain parodies, where the cop has booked an all-expense-paid cruise on the SS Foreshadowing, and then he's talking about the trip that he's going to take with his wife, and then he gets gunned down. Anyway, I thought that was rather deft, because the way we're introduced to this character, we expect to see him again, and then I thought he leapt to his death from a cliff in Scotland. I was like, oh shit, I feel like I thought I knew where I was, and I'm not there. It turns out I was giving the movie too much credit because I was only half paying attention. I think my own imagination had filled in those blanks more capably than Christopher Smith and his collaborators did. So Jenna Malone goes to Scotland, and this is the stretch of the movie that I kind of like. Well, she gets a phone call, obviously. Oh, your brother, I've got bad news. And then, you know, next thing you know, she's in Scotland, and she's talking to the one cop in Scotland. You know, it's the only cop.
Yep. Well, no, he talks to one other cop in one scene for like a line. He's like, did we get a call from the convent or something? And the guy says, no. It's like basically it. So yeah, there's like a cop and like a 1 day a week volunteer policeman.
Yeah, right. He's the sheriff of Scotland, and he's got his one deputy. It's true. It's not just her. You know, it's not like there's a romance angle, and that's why the two of them are always sharing scenes together. He's the only cop that anybody talks to.
Correct.
He's, you know, managing this case single-handed. And the case is that the brother leaped to his death. Obviously, prior to that, he is believed to have slain a priest, like gutted him, basically. Yeah. And Jenna Malone says that's not in his character. He would never kill anyone. He would never kill himself, for that matter. She meets Danny Houston and the Mother Superior, both of whom are ominous in kind of different ways. Danny Houston, we just recognize to be kind of a villainous character actor. You know, has a scene. Oh, no, actually, it's the cop. It's the sheriff of Scotland who says this. The one line that I like, until we get to a scene that's littered with a couple of them with Danny Houston in a minute or two. Anyway, the sheriff says they're walking around the cliffs where the brother did himself in, and he says, this land is owned by the Vatican. Technically, we're not even in Scotland right now. And as he says this, there's a nun off in the distance eyeing them warily. And I sort of liked that. Anytime you're in sort of an in-between place, not quite here, not quite there, that sort of gives you the goose pimples, or at least lays a foundation for future goose pimples. But not much is done with that idea, or indeed any idea.
Yeah. There's the first shot we get of the Mother Superior. She's in the foreground at the convent in like her office, I guess, presumably. And She's just very ominously staring into the distance, muttering under her breath, "There is but one God."
Yeah, she's played by Tom Waits.
Basically. And I just, I think, I'm not going to say that's the moment where the film lost me quite so early, but that was not a good note for me. That no, definitely, that took me out of the movie.
It is a note that the movie continues to play. It's like Christopher Smith's violin only has the one string, and he's just sawing at it like a madman. Evil dies tonight. You know, it's just one of those things. It reads less like a mantra and more like a tick of the screenwriters. like a what the fuck do they, like a Tourette's thing? Like he couldn't help himself. So I might be eliding something. Oh, yeah, we get this was my first major red flag. Jenna Malone starts having fainting spells. She has one in the morgue. She has one like in the next scene on the shoreline. This is when she's watching the nuns leap to their deaths, which turns out to be a hallucination. And she falls into the ocean basically so that she can be divested of her cell phone, which is tidy enough.
But nevertheless, it does sort of lay the groundwork for a bit of fugue soup.
Oh, yes. And the movie, until the last 15, 20 minutes or so, does not get that soupy. But right away, I was like, I don't know. It's getting soupy on me. I don't know about this. And then Danny Houston shows up to save the day, at least momentarily. This is probably my favorite scene overall. They're walking around this ruin, and he points out a sigil of some kind on the ground hewn into the stone. And he calls it the ultimate confessional. He says soldiers returning from the Crusades would stand upon it and then take a step back for every sin they had committed when they were abroad crusading. And behind the sigil, as you're backing away, there's an arch and then a sheer drop into the ocean. So,
And this is where the brother, incidentally, fell/leapt to his death. Yeah. So
obviously the most prolific sinners just backed up all the way. And as Danny Houston puts it, God caught them. There's a couple good lines in this scene. That's one. And then he stands on the sigil and takes two steps back and then says, "Luckily, I only have two sins, cake and coffee." And it's like, I'm inclined to doubt that. You are Danny Houston. I just have this niggling feeling that you might be up to something.
I would like to make a completely inane observation at this point. Danny Houston is also one of the multitude of characters in this film who ominously intones, "There is but one God." Yeah. And the first time he said it, I thought back to 30 Days of Night from 15 years ago, 16 years, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. That movie's standout moment.
Yeah, where he's the leader of the vampires, basically, and whoever he's about to kill is whimpering about God, and he's, "No God."
Yeah, so. And he tilts his head up at the sky in this sort of feral way, as if he's, like, looking for God and doesn't find him. It's a nice touch. Got those jet black eyes.
Yeah.
Much better movie.
Yes, by a lot.
At some point in the... I think it warrants the phrase, the colloquialism that I invented. At some point in this stretch of fugue soup, these soupy waters we're swimming in, there is a flashback to some kind of a Wicker Man pagan witches circle in the woods. We just know at a glance that it's the Middle Ages. It just looks like a promo for a Renaissance fair. It's shot completely differently. It looks very tawdry.
That was my read. It doesn't look like the Middle Ages to me. It looks like a shoddy recreation of the Middle Ages.
Yeah.
And it features, and the little girl's like wearing a mask, so you don't know for sure, but she's got the same sort of long reddish hair that Jenna Malone's character does in the flashbacks we've seen. So there have been a few flashbacks. We haven't really dwelt on them. But I just assumed right off the bat that that was her. And then my first thought is just like, is this some kind of weird-ass LARPing bullshit? Like, Is she doing some kind of make-believe out in the woods, and then these knights in armor coming after her? Are they LARPing? What is happening?
Well, I figured, you know, either she's immortal, or it's a reincarnation bit, or basically until the knights on horseback showed up, which doesn't take very long, I thought maybe this is contemporary, and she was once part of a cult. This is a suppressed memory. Maybe it's a vision of her future. The Mother Superior, I think, tells her at one point that her visions are memories of her past and also memories of her future, memories of events that have yet to befall her, which gives the game away much too much when it comes to several different things that will get in our crosshairs momentarily.
Yeah.
When the final act rolls around. Anyway, I mean, I like the way you put it. There is both too much and not enough going on. And the Wicker Man stuff sticks out like a sore thumb, raises too many questions that the movie is not in a hurry to answer. And so you anticipate the answer. I'm sure we both did, that we both beat the movie to the punch on the big twist. And I don't know exactly what was it that clinched it for me. You just mentioned that there are a few flashbacks to her childhood. Indeed, there are. There's one rather lengthy one where she's in a dog cage. She and her brother and her mother are being abused by the father. We already know from some banter with the only cop in Scotland that that the dad killed the mother and is serving a life sentence. And we see in the flashback him chase the mother out of the house and stab her to death. This is after the daughter slips her the key. So Jenna Malone feels somewhat responsible for this in a kind of rote horror movie about trauma kind of way.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit of a curveball, a little bit of a wild haymaker. The first time it just cuts almost apropos of nothing to her in a kennel.
Uh-huh.
And if the movie had been, I don't know, more rigorous up to this point, it could have played like the flashback in Barbarian, where all of a sudden it's the 80s and it gets very like Henry, like a suburban Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, and you're just following this guy around as he goes grocery shopping. You know, like it could have been a real swerve like that, but it just kind of does feel like another damn thing that the movie's throwing at you. And that 52 pickup kind of chaotic feeling only becomes more of a problem as the movie goes on. There's a line, this might have been what clinched it for me, actually, or the point of no return. The Mother Superior at one point is arguing after hours under cover of darkness with Danny Houston. And he is yelling at them in a mix of, I don't know what, in English. I don't remember if it was Latin.
It's Latin.
Yeah. And he's basically saying that he's God's second in command. You know, he's talking about how they have to answer to him. There's God and then there's me, or whatever he says. It's an okay line. But then she responds with a real kick in the dick of a line, which is, you underestimate her power. And it's like, they're talking about her like she's Anakin. Yeah, right. They're talking about her like she's Anakin Skywalker or fucking Rey or somebody. You know, it's like, what are we? So right away I thought, okay, she's, I don't know, is she the Antichrist? What is she? She's got powers of some kind. Like, that line came out of a Cape Shit movie. All of a sudden, it was just a real record scratch moment for me. And then the real death knell happens not long after. It's another flashback. Okay, so she gets a book that's written all in code, and we don't know right away why she's able to parse it as capably as she does. Turns out that she and her brother devised this rather elaborate, I must say, cipher as children in order to communicate secretly under their father's nose. And he wrote this journal all in their childhood code, and she is going through and translating it, and it's bringing back memories, I think some of which she is meant to have suppressed. Surely some of them. Some of it is news to her. But often the reveals, the like epiphany flashbacks, aren't framed in a way where that really lands. They're often just sort of presented to us, and then it doesn't cut back to her reacting to the sudden realization or the rush of memory.
Right.
The worst offender in this regard is, so we learn very inelegantly, I think Danny Houston tells her, your brother came here because he was investigating the relic. As soon as he said the relic, my heart just sank. And then they don't stop saying it. It's the relic this, the relic that. For the rest of the movie, they never even mix it up with any synonyms. And it just sounds so hokey.
Behold the Coagula.
So whatever, there was some ancient Teutonic order or something that was tasked with guarding this relic at this specific sacred site, and then it all went awry somehow. And so the brother was coming to the convent to investigate that, and he was also coming to this particular convent because he and his sister were supposed to have been sent there as children. They were meant to have been adopted by the nuns, I guess. And we're just sort of told this, and Jenna Malone is like, oh, okay. And then I think the next scene is a flashback, although it's not really framed that way. We just kind of are plopped right into it, of the two of them in the backseat of this car en route to the convent. And the priest in the backseat with them starts getting kind of squirrely, and he forces the boy child out, the brother, and then he says, say it with me, folks. There is but one God. Yeah, there you go. And then he tries to chloroform, Grace is her name, child Jenna Malone, and then the car swerves into an oncoming truck. And the
swerve just looks awful.
Yeah, it's real dopey.
It's as though someone grabbed an object in Photoshop and then just dragged it.
It does. It looks like you're dragging a browser across your desktop. It's
like, that's basically how bad the nun leaping to their death hallucination looks. It's just the nuns kind of like jump out of the arch and then are browser dragged down to the rocks below. Real mess.
The movie is a real mess from here on out. She has a couple interactions with nuns of little to no consequence. There is one nun with an eye patch who is totally mute, who is often shadowing her wherever she goes. And then there's this teenaged nun who's a little bit impish and is always like jumping out and going, peekaboo! And you would expect that to be punctuated by like a James Wan cheapy scare chord, and it isn't. And for maybe the first time ever, I found myself missing that kind of
yeah.
that kind of pointless bombast, just because the movie is so leaden for much of this middle stretch. She eventually goes to visit her dad in prison. And at least from the chloroform scene, if not earlier, I'm thinking, okay, she's Satan spawn of some variety. And there have been other lines to this effect, things that the nuns mutter to one another or to Danny Houston, wicked child, vessel of darkness, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Laying it on real thick. And then, incredibly, she goes to visit her dad in the clink and sits down on the other side of the glass, and the first words out of his mouth are like, oh, you're the Antichrist, ain't you? You know, it's gobsmacking. Well, she says like, hi, dad, or something like that. And he says, your father's in hell with two horns on his head. You know, frankly, I like my version better. it's no less obnoxious at the very least.
Yeah. And in this, we find out that, well, we see in one of the earlier flashbacks to him having murdered the mother and so forth and keeping them in cages, that he comes rampaging back into the house looking for her, and he gets like a thwack on the head. And then we come to find out in this scene that that thwack killed him, and then she brought him back to life.
That's true, and was completely lost on me, I have to say.
Well, he asks her to bring the brother back to life. Do what you did to me. Okay.
I thought, because he starts bashing his forehead against the glass, you know, shortly after saying that. So I thought he was just off his rocker. But you're absolutely right. It is confirmed that she has Pet Sematary powers in this scene. And then she kind of just goes back to the convent in a daze, you know, having it's so awkwardly deployed. Like, it's so clear at this point what she is. And then we get this sort of also-ran twist where the Sheriff of Scotland is talking to the Mother Superior, and she says something kind of cryptic, and then he says, are you saying that Grace is the relic? And I'm like, what? It's a moment when in any other movie like this, the cop character would be like, stop speaking in riddles, old woman. But instead, he's like, oh my God. He immediately picks up what she's putting down. Really woeful screenwriting all throughout what's to come.
So now that Grace is back at the convent, we get a series of inadvertent nun suicides. There are multiple different nuns who basically come to confront her and kill her because she's the Antichrist or something like that.
Yeah.
And multiple times she basically like gets them to turn the knife on themselves.
Yeah.
Or whatever the implement is.
And she's holding her hands up in sort of a defensive pose, as you would if someone was coming at you with a knife. And so it's unclear if she is actually just Dark Phoenix from X-Men or if something is interceding on her behalf. And I think that ambiguity is intentional, but the whiff of cape shittery about it kind of spoils it, even if that's not what's actually happening. What is actually happening
is much worse.
Yeah, is actually stupider than either of those possibilities. And we'll get to that in just a minute or two here.
But the first time it happens too, this is, I think, where the direction falls down the hardest, because it's when she's like down in a catacomb somewhere under the convent, and the one black person in the entire film, there's a nun who's black, goes down there to confront her and kill her, and then ends up turning the knife on herself, and it's got all the tactility of like a spring-loaded stage blade. It's just like the way it goes in, it's just like, oh, nothing's happening there.
Yeah, it's like Juliet stabbing herself in a high school production.
And then it cuts back to Jenna Malone just looking kind of like confused and about to descend back into fugue soup. And then it immediately cuts to the next scene. There's like no impact here at all.
Yeah. And that's closer to the midpoint of the movie, which makes it more galling that it's the only black nun. And also, this is what proceeds to happen a couple times over now that we're in the climax. So there's no sense of escalation.
No.
Unless you're a racist, in which case it's happening to white nuns now. and that right, might register as an escalation. But it's just appalling. So the eye patch nun gets it pretty much exactly the same way. Actually, she gets off easy. Her wrist gets broken.
Yeah. But
they all just have knives. All of the nuns have knives under their frocks, apparently, or whatever you call them. And she is not made to stab herself in the chest, even though the other nun was. Make of that what you fucking will. And then the peekaboo nun, the younger one, goes running off and proceeds to slit her wrists with her own knife. And she's in this little alcove, which we've seen once before. Jenna Malone went in, had a vision of this nun with bleeding wrists, and then peekaboo, did I get you? She's fine. So, a vision of the future. This is what I meant when I said that line earlier was giving the game away, because we just figure, oh, okay, anything that she has a vision of that hasn't happened yet eventually will, and sure enough, it does, pretty much exactly as you would expect it to.
Yeah.
So Jenna Malone winds up staggering into the church proper, and Danny Houston, she's encircled by a bunch of nuns and crowd surfed into a crypt. They carry her aloft and seal her up in this tomb. And once again, massively clumsy, just ungainly writing here. We get another flashback to the Renaissance Fair. And some knight says, in the tomb you shall not age. It's okay. And then it cuts to Danny Houston going, seal the crypt. And, you know, as the great stone lid is sliding shut, a bloody hand comes out to stop it. Jenna Malone's hand. Danny Houston looks up dumbfounded and sees this golden cross with a sharp point. It falls down and it stabs him in the spine, and he spends a minute or so gurgling.
Spitting up blood.
Yeah.
And spoiler alert, apparently he doesn't die.
Do we see him after this? I don't remember that.
We don't see him again, but the Sheriff of Scotland has some line in the denouement where he's like, yep, and Father Romero went back to Rome.
Jesus. Like, yeah, just walk it off, big guy.
It's like the opposite of, and Poochie died on the way back to his home planet.
Right, it's like if we saw Poochie's rocket ship explode, and then a car came up that said, don't worry, he's fine.
He made it to the escape pod.
Take our word for it. That's horrendous. I missed that line completely.
Yeah.
What a shit show. So this is where it gets as soupy as it ever gets. And I have to be very clear about something. I liked the turning. I thought that the turning was, and I liked the ending of the turning, a dog's breakfast, though it may have been. This ending reminded me so much of the ending of that movie, but was just baleful. Like, did absolutely nothing for me. They are alike in the sense that the movie just turns into sand that runs through your fingers. It just evaporates into a vapor. Nothing means anything. Jenna Malone, right up to the point where they do, I was going to call it the "it was all just a dream" twist, but it's actually worse than that. It's the last 10 minutes were a dream twist. You know, the turning does that, and this movie does that. She like jumps off the cliff, and then just a whole bunch of other shit happens, and then we cut back to her falling. At one point, she sees her brother still sporting his suicide bruise. He's got like a fucked up face and an eye that's swollen shut, and he mystifyingly says that she's a good person. This is an issue, actually, and I may get into this more after the break. She is just the most apathetic antichrist in any movie I've ever seen. She is just roped into this role and doesn't want to do anyone any harm, but inadvertently does over and over again, and is just treated with spite and contempt by everyone as though she were pure evil, even though she's just kind of this milquetoast atheist, you know, who's like a dime a dozen in movies like this. There's nothing about the performance or about her dialogue to indicate that she has these darker depths. It's like they just put the Antichrist hat on her head and say, off you go.
Well, but here's, that's all true. There's the flip side to it, though, where there's a series of flashbacks where basically we see that a spectral Jenna Malone has been responsible for all of the magical shit that's happened all the way through the rest of the movie.
This was the stupid ass option C that we were hinting at,
yes,
a few minutes back. It's not the devil interceding on her behalf, nor is it Jenna Malone in the moment using her phoenix powers. It is Jenna Malone bent neck ladying through the movie.
Yes. Yes.
But like in the most flaccid way possible. It's like the stubbed toe lady or something like that. It's really, really weak stuff. But yeah, no, we see her one by one break
murder
the nun's
some
wrist
nuns
and then kill the other nun. Yeah, right. And do everything short of push her brother off the cliff.
And hurl a spiky cross into, non-fatally, into Father Romero's back.
Yeah. There's a scene with the Sheriff of Scotland and I think the Mother Superior in the backseat of his car. And he's talking about how Grace died, jumped to her death, like everyone in this movie at some point or another, who hasn't? And the Mother Superior says something, again, just very MCU, something very...
You know, I don't think it's exactly MCU. It feels like the hackier half of M. Night.
Yes, that's much better. Yeah, it's like something out of Glass. Which,
yes,
is the middle of that Venn diagram.
Yeah.
Yeah, she says she's got obscene power and she will use it for evil until she's stopped. And then we just kind of hang on the shot of her looking out the window, and then we cut away. And we cut to Jenna Malone in a pub with her entomologist friend, who I mistook for her brother back when I thought this was a good movie. Wait a minute.
Ophthalmologist, not entomologist.
Like
he's
I said,
he's an eye doctor, not a bug doctor.
I was faffing about during the first 5 to 10 minutes. Yeah, the two of them are enjoying a pint, and there's a line that indicates that she has started working miracles. Okay, I guess, yeah, he's talking about seeing a patient of his, ophthalmology, and her sight was miraculously restored. So Jenna Malone is, in Antichrist fashion, doing bad miracles, to crib another phrase from Jordan Peele. We already invoked the coagula.
Yeah, right. Behold.
And then we catch up to the opening scene and the nun with the gun and the dirty, hairy glare. And
it is the Mother Superior, incidentally. Yeah.
And a car wipes her out.
Yeah, she gets wiped out by a minicab. That's it. That's the movie.
Roll credits, basically. And this, you know, and the movie has obviously incinerated all of the goodwill I had by this point. But the narration here is theoretically clever. And it's the same line repeated from the beginning of the movie. My brother always said I had a guardian angel. I would like that better if they didn't do the bent neck lady thing and the devil was actually looking out for her all this time. Because the idea that her guardian angel has been Satan all along is a halfway decent twist. The movie just muddies the water way too much, stirs that fugue soup until it just looks like dishwater.
Well, yeah, and ultimately it means that her guardian angel was her all along, which is brainless.
How inspiring. Yeah, well, and talk about brainless. The last shot, for some fucking reason, the camera just pushes in on the back of the cab, and there's a nun bobblehead with its head bobbling in the center of the frame.
An angel, I think, but yeah.
An angel, right. Mea culpa.
More after the break.
Asinine note to end on. Yeah, more after the fucking break.
I'm here from the Vatican because of your brother's death. I've come to bring transparency to this tragedy.
Before he fell into darkness, he was much loved by everyone.
Fell into darkness. You saw my brother kill himself.
The eyes of God are on us all.
This was the ultimate confessional. The nuns, they stand here, and for every sin committed, they take a step back. The more steps they took,
they fell to their death.
God caught them.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. Podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
I come here when I have dark thoughts. I think I might be a really bad person.
Lying.
What is it that you think you know?
Don't be scared. There is but one God.
And we're back. So there's a scene that we elided during the synopsis that I want to touch on just because I thought it was fucking hilarious. There's a flashback, not to the childhood or whatever, but to shortly before the brother killed himself, where he's being held in the convent or the church or whatever, and he's like been pinned under a big slab of wood, like a door or something.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's being tortured in this way for information or to get him to do something or whatever. And the older priest, the one he ended up killing, apparently, says to the group of nuns, like, "Sisters, more weight." And then they just start kind of like bouncing up and down on the board. This is not an exaggeration. It has the flavor of a Monty Python sketch.
Yes, very much so. It's like something out of Castle Anthrax.
It's just the silliest damn thing.
Yeah, and like all the other flashbacks and flash forwards and flash who knows where in this movie, it just is sprung upon us like a mugging. And they're just trampolining on him. And, you know, in real life, that would be painful. But it's also just a silly-ass way to torture somebody. And it doesn't help that the priest, who winds up getting gutted, I guess, by the brother, this is the only time we hear him speak, and he's also got kind of a funny voice. So the whole scene is straight out of Holy Grail. You're absolutely right.
Well, and what amplifies it, too, is they don't look like they're trying to apply as much pressure as possible. When they're hopping up and down, it's kind of like a limp little 2 or 3 inch jump somehow.
Yeah, which, a jig.
Which is really what drives home the Castle Anthrax flavor, for sure. It probably still would have been incredibly dumb if they had been like jumping up and then coming down hard, but at least that would have been a little bit more of an attempt to sell it. This is just silly.
There's a scene which is much less farcical than the one you described, much more low-key, but for me it kind of epitomizes this movie, just what it's like to watch the movie, or at least the bulk of it, you know, especially the middle stretch. There's a scene where Grace, Jenna Malone, is poring over this journal, and she's like reading it by candlelight. I think she's sitting in a pew or something like that, and then it cuts to Danny Houston off in the shadows. And he's silhouetted. It's not a terrible shot, actually. His silhouetted form is kind of looking down on her. And then he turns like halfway to the camera and goes, hmm, and then wanders out of frame.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I can't think of a less consequential scene than that. It's just like, what was he thinking?
I forgot about that.
Well, why would you remember it? You forget it while it's happening, unless you're me, apparently. I filed it away just because it was so exquisitely pointless. and it comes in just the middle of a sea of pointlessness. I can't fathom why it's written the way it is. As if the there is but one God thing wasn't bad enough. I mean, that bothered me, but the word relic being parroted over and over actually bothered me much more. The scene where she finds out about it, again, it's Danny Houston just kind of taking a spicy hot exposition dump all over her head. He says, your brother came here to find the truth about the relic. And he says it like we've heard it before. And she's like, the relic, what's that? You know, and it just turns into this video game cutscene out of nowhere. You know, at one point, he's talking about the history of the relic. And she says, and this is verbatim, so where is it now? I feel like I'm watching a slideshow. This just turned into, it's like a Wishbone episode or something. You know, why is it written like this? That was flabbergasting, as so many of these scenes are. We get carts before horses, chronically, as I said before we even got into the plot synopsis, after it has been made abundantly fucking clear that she's the daughter of the devil. Even if you're real thick, the prison scene impresses it upon you unmistakably. And then we get the scene with the cop and the nun, the mother superior, where he's like, Grace is the relic. And it's like, we never really find out what that means. You know, I mean, I guess she is the cursed thing, artifact. There's a nice word for you. You can stick that one in your fucking screenplay just to alleviate some of the misery.
Yeah.
She is the item, the relic, the artifact, what have you, the cursed thing that was sealed away and then went missing. All right, that's fine. But after that scene, which necessarily comes after the prison scene, we get a scene of Grace returning to the convent, and I think that she's just killed one or more nuns. It might be right before she goes staggering into the church and gets crowd surfed into the tomb where she doesn't age.
The tomb, what doesn't make you old?
You're right. I wonder if you put the tomb on the beach, which one's eldritch influence would win out over the other.
I think it just makes time normal. cancel each other out. So if they had had the tomb on the beach, they could have put the girl in there, and then she could have given birth to the baby.
Right.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, that's a fucking Freddy versus Jason mashup that I don't care to contemplate any further. So after it has been made clear time and time again that she's Satan's spawn, she comes back to the convent, and there's a line where she just says to herself and to us, "It's me, isn't it?" It's like, yes. Yes, it is you. You're the relic. You're the Antichrist. I'm beyond caring at this point, so it doesn't even really matter to me that you're harping on about it. But I can't conceive of what theoretical dunce this movie was written for. It's like, there is no one dim enough to not get it by that point. I just don't know why anything happens in the order it happens in. It's got very profound structural problems, even if the dialogue had a lot of pep and zing to it, which it seldom does, outside of the one or two examples I tossed off from the movie's first act.
Yeah.
I think that's all I've got. It's really, really a train wreck. And I liked the turning, you know? I mean, I was
infamously so, yes.
Yeah, I thought it was like a mediocre movie that then just got so sublimely weird right at the end, and so dumb. I mean, let's not mince words. You know, the ending is disastrous in a sense, but it was like kind of, I don't know. I left the theater, and you were like vibrating with anger, I remember.
Yes.
I might even talk about this in the episode. I'm getting deja vu just sitting here. But I remember feeling like I had this like little, this little secret, this little chestnut of like this hot take that I was going to nurture all the way back to your place where we were recording that day and all the way through the plot rundown. And then I unveiled my hot take, which is, it was okay. it's not, I don't even think it's a masterpiece or anything. It just is such a rug pull at the end that I was kind of taken with it, even while I recognized that it was completely harebrained. And as you memorably put it, a dog's breakfast. This movie is every bit as harebrained, but has just no magic, no pizzazz. It just, I think in our review of The Turning, I likened it to feeling, it was more significant than just like a rug pull. It felt like a hatch had opened up under me and I had just plunged. that's how disorienting the ending is. I treasure the memory of the lights coming up suddenly, very suddenly in the theater, and the that's it feeling hitting everyone at once and like audible groans. And I was just sitting there like bewildered and just trying to, very quickly giving up on trying to make sense of any of it. Anyway, this time I got that same hatch feeling, but this time there was a rope around my neck. You know, it was like, yeah, it was like none of the exhilaration, just the feeling of being put to death. The movie's like an execution, especially towards the end. And it is not without promise at the beginning, which is maybe why I was so disappointed by it. It certainly didn't help.
Well, and The Turning, even for me, seemed occasionally promising early on. And then, yes, I hated it a lot by the end.
I would not begrudge anyone that hatred. It's mincemeat. It's nonsense. It's confetti. It's like storytelling confetti. It's gibberish.
So it's kind of interesting that on the subject of consecration, you and I both agree that there's really nothing to recommend it. But at the same time, there's so little there that it inspires much less vitriol on my part. And I sense your part also. It's just kind of stupid and nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, granted, you did just compare it to an execution. But nevertheless, yeah, but, I feel like you weren't all that moved by it.
Like Danny Houston's execution in this movie, I'm just going to walk it off. You know, I'll be fine.
go back to Rome.
So if you want to watch a much better movie, actually the best movie set in a spooky convent, look no further than Black Narcissus. Mm. I wouldn't trot out a Powell and Pressburger movie in any old episode. I think because this movie is so bad, I feel a certain urge to make the pendulum swing all the way in the other direction. And yeah, I mean, it's never been topped. It's not a horror movie per se. It does have, I think, a quite scary climax, more than just suspenseful, like actually properly scary climax. Mm-hmm. And there's no supernatural element, but it's, about nuns in a convent up in the mountains dealing with earthly troubles, the vicissitudes of the flesh, trying to conquer their demons and their desires. And one of them goes off the deep end, and there's a little more to it than that, but there kind of needn't be. I mean, I remember a subplot, or half remember a subplot, or more than one, but the spine of the movie is the thread that leads up to that stellar climax. I remember channel surfing in 9th or 10th grade and crossing paths with Turner Classic Movies, and it just happened to be that shot of the evil sister emerging in the doorway on the, on top of the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very striking. It's like something out of The Grudge. She's got a pale, almost like a kabuki theater, like demonic face and dark locks hanging over her eyes. And I was immediately like, well, I have to watch this immediately. And I immediately changed the channel because I didn't want to know what happened next. I just wanted to go into it knowing as little as possible. Other than that, I had been hooked by that image, which is very arresting. So I don't have a true blue horror recommendation for you today. Black Narcissus is a real good time.
So I'm going to recommend a British revenge thriller from, 2 years ago, but became available here in the States last year. One of those deals. Mm-hmm. Relatively recent in any case. It's called Bull. And it's about this man, an ex-mob enforcer who's been missing for 10 years, presumed dead, and basically he comes back and starts taking his revenge on the people who wronged him. And it's very lean and mean, no BS, not a lot of fluff to it. It's, I think when you take out the credits, just under 90 minutes. So it's all business. And spoilers for Bull, because this is a little bit of an interesting twist. I'm giving the warning, but this is also the reason why it makes sense as a recommendation. It does get to be a bit of a horror movie at the end, because we find out that Bull has in fact been dead the whole time, and he's basically just a revenant.
Hell yeah.
So, there you go.
I'm here for that kind of a high plains drifter sort of a deal. I was already on my to-do list. It just moved up a ways. I'll have to check that one out.
Yeah. So I thought that was a neat twist, and it's better than I was the relic the whole time, even though similarly flavored, I would say.
Imagine if you can how put out I was by her tete-a-tete with her dead brother at the end. Given that I did not grok in the prison scene that she had pet cemeteried her dad when she was a kid. I just thought this is completely fucking unprepared for. And then it turned out to not matter because they do the it was all just a dream. No, actually, only the last 10 minutes were a dream thing. Because she's still falling to her death. I don't know. It's not. I don't want to run the fugue soup thing into the ground. I'm fond of fugue soup. I'm fond of bathtub wife. I don't want to beat dead horses here. Ebert had his little movie glossary and I've got mine. But at the risk of overextending the metaphor, if you try to suss out one part of the soup from the other, you're basically just drowning. You're just being waterboarded with bilge. I've now compared the movie to being tortured and being executed. So I guess it does have my dander up. But yeah, I don't know. It's already getting away from me. I'm just going to let it go, I think.
Well, the guardian angel that is Jenna Malone, protecting Jenna Malone, having annihilated the Mother Superior with the front bumper of a minicab, we can put this fucker to bed. But until next time, I'm Jim Smith.
I met Sharon Tacy.
We are.
I just remembered the fucking bobblehead.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We'll see you later.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Consecration Official Trailer HD IFC Films, uploaded by IFC Film. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, June 11th, and we will be discussing the British folk horror film Ennismain. See you then.